from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Despite years of warnings from the scientific community about the threat of environmental breakdown, people have not much changed their ways. Biofuturist Paul Ehrlich is asking why. Tonight on Point, nature, human nature, and why the world ignores the risk of global environmental collapse. But first, the price of crude oil passed $40 a barrel yesterday, its highest level since 1990. The average price of a gallon of gasoline in the United States last week reached a record high of $1.85 a gallon, and in some cities is passing $3 a gallon. The White House predicts gasoline prices will continue to rise this summer. Neela Banerjee covers the U.S. economy and international affairs for the New York Times. I asked her why oil and gas prices are headed up now.
Well, there's a confluence of factors, and I would say that what has been underpinning the steady rise in prices for a while now is the fact that the global economy has rebounded, and you have great demand in the United States, as usual, but surprisingly high demand in China. And at the same time, oil-producing countries are basically maxed out at capacity, and there's very little spare capacity in the world. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the Emirates are the few places where there is spare capacity. The kind of oil that they could provide is really not the kind of oil that most countries want right now. It's a different grade of oil. It's heavier. So basically those things have come together to make things very rough. And add to that, over the last few weeks, real nervousness about the security of oil installations in the Middle East, given the attacks in Saudi Arabia and Iraq.
I hear you saying something different than we normally hear. Not that OPEC is squeezing down supply, but that there simply aren't the supplies available, and security concerns are what's driving these higher prices.
The problems go back quite a distance to things like OPEC cuts, you know, maybe a year ago or so. Things like the political problems in Venezuela that led to a shutdown of oil production there, and it's still not come back to the levels it was at before the strikes in Venezuela last year. So you have some oil missing there. OPEC has done things that have unnerved the market by saying they were going to make cuts and lowering their quotas. But in fact, their official quota is 23.5 million barrels. Mm. And people I've talked to have said that they're producing something like 25.7. So they're overproducing, too, because the prices are so high. So does OPEC play a role? Well, yeah, of course it does. But is OPEC determining which way prices go up or down single-handedly? No.
Neela, take us for a tour, then, of gasoline prices and oil prices. We're hearing this morning about $3 a gallon gasoline prices in California. Mm. Put these in historical context. Get oil over $40 a barrel today. How do these prices, of wherever we are with gasoline now and with oil, stack up in an historical context?
In absolute terms, gasoline prices are not as high as they were in the early 80s. And Americans spend a smaller percentage of their income now on energy-related costs, including utilities and gasoline, than they did, say, 25 years ago. Hmm. We spend about 5% of our income now on that, as opposed to 10% in the early 80s. So what that means is that even though gasoline prices are high, if you adjust for inflation, they may not be that high. And if you adjust for the fact that, you know, there's greater affluence in the society, they're not that painful.
And will that be true even if the national average gas price hits $1.94 this summer, as the federal government is now forecasting?
There's an interesting wrinkle here. And I mean, those facts, I think, bear themselves out. I mean, there are statistics from the Energy Administration that show that portion of income. But mm-hmm. what a lot of economists have talked about is that, you know, this last round of tax breaks has given back Americans about $75 billion. The increase in crude oil prices, I think it's crude oil prices, has taken sort of a $35 billion bite out of spending, as it were. So right now, what we've gotten back from tax cuts has offset that. The issue, though, is that people think that roughly sometime in July or August, the impact of those tax cuts will dwindle. And then we'll be facing, you know, maybe the true effects of these high fuel prices. So that's sort of what to watch for.
Not to mention that the tax cuts have gone toward the upper income, whereas higher gas prices hit everybody who drives to work.
They do. And one thing that I think gets lost in the mix is that most Americans, sort of middle class to more affluent Americans, spend a smaller percentage of their income on gasoline. And lower income Americans spend more of their income on gasoline, more percentage-wise, than more affluent Americans do. And so, you know, it really does hit the poor hardest, especially in places where there's no public transportation that they can turn to.
Now, oil prices, over $40 a barrel today. This is approaching the all-time high of $41.15. I guess it hasn't been this high since the early 90s, is that right?
Yes, in the early 90s, right.
So this driven by the uncertainty over supply and security issues that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I think the run-up that you've seen over the last two or three weeks, we had in a story today that oil prices have increased about 9%, if not a little bit more, because of the security concerns in the Middle East.
And that's very specific. That's very practical concerns about pipelines being blown up or oil terminals at ports being blown up or disrupted.
Well, being targets, you know, whether they'll actually be blown up or not is another question, but that they're targets because people who are against the United States and friendly regimes like Saudi Arabia want to go for that crucial economic core. As what people are looking to in the future, I think because they expect to see economic growth and sustained high demand in the United States and China, they think the prices will stay high, meaning in the 30s through the rest of this year. $40 a barrel is probably not sustainable, but somewhere between 30 and 36, a lot of people I've spoken to think that's sustainable for some time.
And is there a scenario, Neela Banerjee, anytime in the near future where prices might just shoot way up, that instead of 40 we'd have 50 or $60 a barrel, a doubling or tripling, is that just not in the cards?
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, and you know, anything can happen given such volatile times. The most obvious thing that could set the price of oil that much higher are successful attacks on major oil installations in the Middle East. But I don't find that terribly probable right now.
Neela Banerjee, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Neela Banerjee is a reporter for the New York Times. She spoke with me from New York. In The Day After Tomorrow, an upcoming sci-fi disaster film due for release Memorial Day weekend, Mother Nature bites back at humankind with an onslaught of abrupt global climate change.
What is causing this weather?
Science fiction sells movie tickets, but real science doesn't seem to draw the same kind of attention. There is broad consensus in the scientific community that human activity is straining the global environment, potentially catastrophically. But life and business seem to go on, or try to go on, as usual. From gas guzzlers as oil runs low to an explosion of sushi bars as the seas empty of fish, people seem unwilling to change their behavior, despite evidence that perhaps they should. This hour on Point, Paul Ehrlich on nature versus human nature and why the world ignores the risk of global environmental collapse. Is humanity driving willingly over an environmental cliff, or do you expect technology and markets to save the day, even if the day is late? Is the United States leading the world toward a sustainable future or away from it? And why? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Paul Ehrlich, professor of biology and population studies at Stanford University. His 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb, predicted an explosion in population and nightmare consequences. He is now co-author with his wife, Anne, of the new book, One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future. Good evening and welcome, Paul Ehrlich.
Nice to be there.
Thank you very much.
Wherever we are.
Well, we are in Boston and all over the country, and we're delighted to have you with us. Nineveh, that's an old city, doesn't even exist anymore, sits where Iraq is now. Why are you citing that in your title, Paul Ehrlich?
Well, when Austin Henry Layard, a British archaeologist, got there in about 1848, there was the center of the Assyrian Empire was just a pile of dirt because people in Mesopotamia hadn't paid attention to the degeneration of their environment. And now we have our tanks there trying to protect what we were just talking about, steady oil supplies for a civilization that should be moving as fast as possible away from burning coal and oil and more towards gas and renewable resources. So the parallels are absolutely stunning, but there's a huge difference. The leaders in Assyria didn't have a clue as to what was gradually happening to their society due to salinization of their fields and deforestation of the hills, whereas our society, our leaders have been warned amply and nobody pays any attention to them.
So you go back and you look at Nineveh 6 centuries before the birth of Christ. Rudyard Kipling wrote about it in 1897 in his poem Recessional. You quote him in the front of the book, "Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre, two vanished cities. Judge of the nation, spare us yet, lest we forget, lest we forget." You're saying now, Paul Ehrlich, that it's not about forgetting. We know and we ignore the evidence of environmental threat. Why?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. First of all, most people feel helpless to do anything about it. Second of all, we are afflicted with a huge surge of what we call brown lash talk. That is, people trying to conceal what's happening because it goes against their immediate economic interests. The Luntz Group has basically forbidden our president from saying the words global warming for fear that someone will realize that actually the scientific community is essentially united, that it is a potentially extremely serious problem, that we may already be seeing effects, and that it produces something like a 10% chance of a catastrophe that could basically end our civilization. Only a 10% chance. There's also a 10% chance we might get away with it and just lose a few island nations. But, again, a 10% chance, pretty big chance. If somebody told you the soup you were going to have for dinner tonight had cyanide in it, 10% chance, you probably wouldn't eat it.
Paul Ehrlich, you've had a career of many honors and a lot of publishing and a lot of study. You've also taken your hits from those who didn't like your initial message in the population bomb and saw exaggeration there, that there were nightmares that did not come to pass. And I think in the years since, you have on some of those fronts acknowledged yourself that some of what you envisioned as possible was overblown. Give us a sense of should we see Paul Ehrlich as crying wolf today, or?
You know, you should see Paul Ehrlich as a scientist who's had everything, including the population bomb, vetted by other scientists. It doesn't mean that everything in the population bomb was right or that everything in one with Nineveh is right, because science doesn't give you certainty. And all science can do is give you its best current estimate. And in fact, the population bomb, in retrospect, was much too optimistic a book. It's true that on the pessimistic side, we were too pessimistic about how rapidly the Green Revolution would spread, although much of the starvation that was predicted in it by agricultural scientists came about. But you got to remember, in the population bomb, we did not mention that global warming was going to be a problem now conceived for the early part of this century. Mm-hmm. We thought it would be the late part.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know about the depletion of ozone, which almost ended our civilization. We were just lucky there. We didn't know about what, you know, the next disease. We warned against virus diseases like AIDS getting into the human population, but we had not yet had the example of AIDS. We didn't know how rapidly we were destroying tropical forests and biodiversity. So overall, the warnings of the population bomb were not strong, or they were basically inadequate. But again, you show me a scientist who everything they said 35 years ago proves to be right, and I will say they're not in a very active science.
Our ears are wide open tonight, and here I think we all relate to the fundamental thing you're pointing at, that we have for years now had these warnings poured into our ears, and yet each of us in our personal lives, in our national life, in our global life, it is clear that the response is not on the same scale as the potential threat, and we hear you banging the pots and pans just as loudly as you can in this new book, Paul.
Well, one of the problems is, of course, that people are not really well informed, particularly by the media, about what's going on. There was a quite favorable review of the book in the San Diego newspaper yesterday,
mm-hmm.
but it said the population explosion that Ehrlich predicted in the population bomb never came about. Well, A, I have never predicted done any of the predicting. That's all done by the UN and the Population Reference Bureau. That's A. B, when the population bomb was written, there were 3.5 billion people. Now there's almost 6.5. We've added more people since that book was published in 1968, almost 50% more than were alive when I was born. That's not a population explosion.
It's a crowded planet, we concede.
Yeah, all you got to do is try and drive into Boston or San Francisco someday, and you don't have to, you know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to determine there's a problem with how many people we have.
But you've done a lot of thinking about why we aren't acting on what we know. We're going to look at that tonight. Paul Ehrlich, please stand by. His new book is One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future. You can join this conversation. Is the planet addressing its environmental problems or ignoring them? And if it is ignoring, why? And is the U.S. leading the world toward a sustainable future or away from it? Again, why. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about why the world resists dealing with major threats to the global environment. My guest is Paul Ehrlich, professor of population studies and biology at Stanford University, and author, co-author with his wife, Anne, of the new book, One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future. You can join our conversation tonight in your own day-to-day. Do you push huge environmental issues to the side? Why? Is humanity driving over a cliff almost willfully, or do you expect technology and the markets to save the day, even if the day is late? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Ehrlich, you began to describe the mindset and the political structures that the world sits in, not responding to this potential environmental calamity. I wish you'd elaborate on those. Paint the picture of what you see going on.
Let me first of all say that evolutionarily, both culturally and genetically, we were not designed to look at the kinds of problems we have today. We're a small group animal, and for most of our 5 million years of history or so, if the environment was gradually changing over, say, a decadal period over 10 or 20 or 30 years, we weren't designed to detect that because there was not a damn thing we could do about it. You know, a rock coming at us or a tiger leaping at us, we know exactly what to do about that. But a very slow buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere or a gradual accumulation of nuclear weapons in our arsenals and so on, that's harder to come to grips with.
So part of this is biological, genetic, evolutionary. Yeah. Let's just look at that one first. Is that something we're capable of overcoming intellectually if it's in the genes?
Well, yeah, we're capable of overcoming intellectually because the scientific community is scared as hell. I mean, you know, the world scientist warning to humanity said human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment on critical resources. Fundamental changes are urgent if we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about. In other words, you can be trained to do it, but one of the places that I and other scientists have failed has been in educating the public about science and technology. I mean, you've got an educated audience. I suspect that a bunch of them have technical backgrounds. All you have to ask is if you look at what passes for the intellectual discourse in our society, if you look at what politicians say, or if you listen to Face the Nation or Meet the Press on Sunday morning, and you listen to somebody like Robert Novak or Charles Krauthammer or even, God forbid, Rush Limbaugh, have you, those of you who are listening who have any technical background, have you ever heard a coherent sentence on a technical issue from any of those people?
So what sustains or permits that misguided conversation, if that's what it is?
Well, we do a lousy job in our schools of teaching science. We scare people away from it. Science and technology are at least half of our culture, whether we like it or not, but we don't put the effort in it, even at Stanford. We do not require the kind of science we ought to have all our undergraduates, just like we do require English, we do require some knowledge of our civilization, but we don't require knowledge of the technical part of our civilization, which is, of course, where most of the problems lie today.
So you're citing evolution, first of all. Here you're citing ignorance of science, which makes a citizenry that's not necessarily prepared to judge the conversation, but you go right on to interests and politics, Paul Ehrlich.
Of course. As I suspect you know, our society is not functioning the way our founding fathers thought it ought to. They thought we ought to have a representative form of government, that is, Republican small r, because they were scared of the amount of influence that special interests could have if we had a democratic small d type of government. And that's why they set up the kind of representative government that the Constitution requires. But unfortunately, the way the media work now, the politicians, instead of going to Washington and making the decisions on the basis of their presumably superior knowledge and access to information and so on, instead are looking over their shoulders at polls all the time and are being able to be pressured by huge corporations which have in our system the same rights as you or I. And many people think that corporations as fictitious individuals were, you know, this was somehow handed down on stone tablets from a mountain in Israel thousands of years ago, but actually it's the product of very clever railway attorneys in about 1876.
Giving corporations the rights of individuals. But even then, Paul Ehrlich, why shouldn't corporations care about environmental circumstances?
Well,
they have long horizons, too. They have major capital invested that wants a return for a long time.
Some do. And some are beginning, as I've often talked to corporate groups, and I always recommend that every corporation, every big one, should have a vice president for foresight who looks more than a couple of years down the road. It's partly an issue, an economic issue. It's an issue of discount rates. If you discount the future at 5 or 6%, as our economy tends to, then 10 years from now, does it make any difference? But the people in corporations care, and there are a lot of people in the corporate world who understand the direction we're going. For example, the oil companies are deserting the Western Fools Association, which was the big there is no global warming outfit, and moving the smart ones are moving to becoming energy companies because they realize the days of just burning oil are going to come to an end.
But overall, in your critique, you are not happy with corporate influence or with the wealth behind it. You write, "Today, the political right uses its power to make further enrichment of the wealthy the primary goal of social policy, blithely confident that decay of the human environment, even if serious, will not be a grave problem for those with the financial means to keep their personal surroundings safe and pleasant." In other words, as you say, this idea of rich nations or rich communities within rich nations being able to live in kind of environmental gated communities, ultimately.
Well, that's where we're getting back to the ignorance thing, because, of course, we can't. We're all tied into an epidemiological environment that is deteriorating to the horror of the scientific community very rapidly. I serve on the Board of Life Sciences of the National Academy, and much of our discussion is over what we can do to protect ourselves not just from bioterrorism, but also from the deterioration of the natural environment caused by too many people crowding too close to the animal reservoirs of disease, the sorts of things that brings us SARS and could bring us a killer flu and so on, where we are leaving ourselves unarmed. One of the things that the people I know are horrified by is the way the current administration is making us more vulnerable to that sort of thing and more vulnerable to terrorism by creating a huge recruiting poster for Al-Qaeda by attacking Iraq and not doing the things that we need to do to protect our borders and ourselves from terrorism or to deal with the roots of terrorism.
Ultimately, you describe the United States and maybe the developed world as hostages to hubris. What do you mean by that?
Well, the same way that I'm sure the Assyrian leaders, they had the first real empire. They had a very effective method for stealing other people's stuff and shipping it back to Nineveh.
From right there between the Tigris and Euphrates. Yeah.
What?
From right there between the Tigris and Euphrates, where your soldiers
right.
are now.
And they were undoubtedly very self-satisfied. Well, again, look at our administration. Look at the people on the various programs I mentioned, and they're very satisfied. People, first of all, we're at the top of the heap. And one of the assumptions that people at the top of the heap tend to make is that the system must be wonderful because we floated to the top. And I keep trying to explain to them that other things besides cream float, but it doesn't seem to get through.
Yes, thanks for that. But your point there gets back, I guess, to the gated community. You're saying that hubris leads people to imagine that whatever happens, it won't hit them or won't hit them first. You're saying don't count on that.
That's right. I'm saying we are tied in with, for example, what happens to the poor people in the world. That, in fact, the more weak poor people we have with damaged immune systems, the more likely it is that nasty diseases, more of them, like AIDS, will get into the population. And, for example, the situation in Africa is very seriously deteriorating because of AIDS now, and the same thing might happen in China. But look at just the SARS scare, which was a relatively harmless thing compared to some of the other organisms that could move from animals into our population and give us another AIDS-like epidemic, or worse. Just think of what will happen to the economy if we get a killer flu that knocks off hundreds of millions of people, often dying within a week. Very possible. We're not prepared.
We're talking tonight with Paul Ehrlich, author of the new book, One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future. He's got a lot of prescriptions for how to tackle the problem as he sees it. We'll get to those, but I want to get to your calls first. Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Great conversation. I think just from the title of the book, I think it's right on the money in a couple of respects. The first is that in a world order that's led by the United States, where consumption is the whole raison d'etre, the whole reason you live, get an education, get married. It's all about the accumulation of stuff and the consumption of stuff. And if you take that in combination with this myth of the individual that's completely self-sufficient, that's not related to the rest of the world or the environment, it's a formula for disaster, and I think that's precisely where we're at. We educate and we proliferate these two big ideas, one the idea of consumption and one the myth. I call it a myth because it's completely unfounded in reality, that somehow we're all these unrelated individuals. And that's how I think that's why we're headed for disaster, because the reality is that, you know, as long as there's economic injustice in the world, for instance, there will always be violence, and no one will be able to escape it, no matter how gated your community is.
And yet an awful lot of progress has come out of systems that are not necessarily economically just, and individuals have taken us to some incredible breakthroughs, Sam.
Well, it's like a Ponzi game. You know, it depends what slice of the triangle you look at. If you look at a certain slice of the triangle, things are great at the top. But if you look at the whole triangle, it's a disaster. So, sure, people in the United States are doing great. But it's really through accounting irregularities, because we don't take into account the effect that it has on the rest of the planet.
Sam, we've got it. Let us pick it up. Paul Ehrlich, this of course.
Obviously, I agree with him. One of the huge problems is that much of our prosperity is built not on living on our income, but living on our capital. We in the rich countries are burning the planet's capital very fast. That is our deep, rich agricultural soils, our fossil groundwater, the biodiversity that runs our life support systems. And you got to remember, 3 billion people, that is half again as many as who were alive when I was born, are living on less than $2 a day today, while the average European cow is subsidized to the tune of $2.50 a day.
But this goes, and Sam raises this, it goes to a couple of core things that I really have to ask you about. You don't seem to share a confidence in a couple of things that are bedrock areas of confidence for many Americans. One is markets' ability to look at situations and respond to them, and the other is technology, which time and again has, you know, pulled our chestnuts out of the fire. Why don't you give those more credence?
Let me respond to both of them. First of all, I'm a great fan of markets doing the things that they do well, and in fact, they do many things well. But I think the biggest mistake we made from the welcome collapse of the Soviet Union was assume that markets that were unrestricted were the way to run the world. And that's silly. I work all the time with first-rate economists. Not one of them would say that. What you have mostly is people who say write for the Wall Street Journal's editorial pages and read a few lines of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, but never read his theory of moral principles, which gave the background in which markets had to operate.
Yeah, but you don't just look at a little nipping and tucking on markets. You're saying here, to quote you, economic growth among the already rich is not a sensible primary goal of public policy at this point in human history. Economic growth is fairly central.
That's absolutely correct. I'm in fact an author on a paper that is now in press in the leading economic journal in the world, with the lead author being Ken Arrow, who is a Nobel laureate in economics, and I think most economists consider him the best economist in the world, and four or five of his colleagues.
But how can you and he be...
The title of the paper is, yeah. Are We Consuming Too Much? And the answer is yes.
I just practically, it's hard for me to get my mind around how you support markets but oppose economic growth. Don't you have to have growth in a market-driven system?
No, you do not have to have growth in a market-driven system. You're told you have to have growth in a market-driven system, but of course you don't have to. You can have some companies expand and other companies shrink, and the aggregate throughput in the economy can actually decline in a market system if it's properly regulated.
But anytime our growth gets below 2% or so, you know, the bells are ringing all over the place.
That's
in
right,
alarm.
Because really dumb economists talk to really dumb politicians and produce that. Sure. You know, the economy starts to shake and they say, oh boy, go out and buy two more Hummers. Well, you know, again, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. If you think that our economy can grow forever, then I have a bridge in Brooklyn that I'll sell to you. We have a finite planet. It's in deep trouble.
What about technology, then, and innovation? No growth, where's the job? I do want a job to eat on this planet.
Well, first, again, there are very complex issues of how you arrange things so that people are not all in deep trouble because we don't have economic growth anymore. First of all, the economic growth has produced the kind of situation I just described, where half the world is left behind. That's not very good, and that sort of builds terrorism, which is not going to be good for our economy, growing or not. Second thing, you know, the time has come to face the facts. And let me show you how you can have non-economic growth and actually improve things for everybody and reduce consumption.
Okay.
It's very simple. In the United States, the first thing you would do is say, we're going to reverse the trend of the last 70 years and redesign the United States around people instead of around automobiles. And we are going to restore mass transit systems. We're going to redesign our cities over the next 70 years so people can walk to work in many cases, bike to work in others, work at home on, you know, virtual offices and computers. That would reduce our economic growth greatly. It would also improve our health. It would make the planet more sustainable. It would reduce our consumption. That's not the kind of thinking you get out of people who have not thought deeply about what the problems of the planet are and what our problems are.
Christian is calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Christian. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to just make the line very clear in the, between the two programs you've had this evening. We've got a future where we can either get off this addiction to oil, or we can anticipate more colonial-style American domination of the world, where we're going to see more repression at the hands of American soldiers or client states of the kind we've been seeing in the prisons in Iraq. Because there's just no way that a democratically run free Iraq is going to let us have all the oil we want at $40 a barrel or $30 a barrel.
Well, Saudi Arabia has done it, not exactly democratic, but if we're willing to pay good hard cash, you don't think they'll give up the oil?
Right, but we're not there to have just the to have it on their terms. We're there to have it on have the place protected and on our terms, so that there's no kind of question of nationalization of oil fields or other kinds of things that would use the oil to benefit them rather than keeping the steady flow going for us.
So you're saying it's not just an environmental issue, but a political issue, or your word, pressure to go almost colonial. Christian, thanks for your call. Paul Ehrlich, how do you see a connection between what's going on in Iraq and your assessment of politics and consumption?
Oh, he's exactly right. Precisely. The West has been trying to gain control of Middle East oil basically for 100 years. It all started actually with Churchill when he was Lord of the Admiralty and discovered that battleships were going to run on petroleum instead of on coal. Pierre Salinger wrote about 15 years ago. He said Iraq was created by Churchill, who had the mad idea of joining two widely separated oil wells at Kirkuk and Mosul by uniting three widely separated peoples, the Kurds, the Sunni, and the Shiites. It is strictly a resource war. There's whole books on this. People are just ignorant about it. The only reason, well, as one of my colleagues said, Gretchen Daly, said when we were about to invade Iraq, do you suppose we'd be about to invade Iraq if their major export were broccoli? I mean, look, the government lied about why we were going in there repeatedly. It's still busily lying about it. I mean, you can tell when George Bush is lying by simply watching whether his lips are moving.
Paul Ehrlich, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking with Paul Ehrlich. His new book is One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future. You can join the conversation. Does Paul Ehrlich sound like a dreamer or the ultimate pragmatist? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about nature, human nature, and why the world ignores the risk of global environmental collapse. My guest is Paul Ehrlich. 1968, he wrote The Population Bomb. Now he's written with his wife, Anne, One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future. You can join our conversation. Does Paul Ehrlich sound like a dreamer or the ultimate pragmatist? Will we argue about global warming until our goose is cooked? And do humans have the capacity to deal with long-term threats, with the environmental threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jenny is calling from Boston. Hi, Jenny. You're on the air.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I'm from Somalia, and I come from a country that, you know, a lot of people have been nomads for, you know, for thousands of years and have lived that way for happily, I should say. But, you know, I think that the Western world is pressuring developing countries to sort of modernize using their models. And I think that there is this unhealthy pressure for Western countries to sort of not think through some of the ways that they develop. And I just wanted your guest to sort of comment on how developing countries, what options do developing countries have?
But Jenny, let me ask you, I've seen Somalia and how Somali nomads live, and it is rough by American standards, not to mention many others.
But
it is a very rough life, and I've seen those people reach out very quickly for a motorbike, for example, when it's available. I mean, do you really think that people should or would live in those circumstances if they had options that involved more consumption, to use the dreaded word here?
I think the entire model, the entire capitalistic model is very skewed, because I think that even though it is a harsh lifestyle, I don't think that working 9 to 5 without a life is any easier, to be honest with you. You sort of lose some things and you gain some things. But I think it's for the Somalis to sort of build their own concept of developing. But I think the Western world, you know, in addition with the help of the IMF and the World Bank, is setting these standards where countries, and let's forget Somalia, but China and India, have to sort of develop using these concepts that are, you know, bad for the environment.
Jenny, we've got it. Checking in from Somalia. Thanks so much for calling. Paul Ehrlich, our time is short. Let's go right to your prescriptions here for the developing world, for the developed world.
Well,
what do you say?
I think there's much to what she says. After all, I live with the Eskimos, and one of the advantages...
Pardon me? In Stanford?
What?
You lived, you said.
That was when I was a kid.
I see, yeah.
But one of the things they had was that they were the possessor of most of their culture, each individual. We're not. But I don't think we have a very attractive culture. There are many good aspects to it. But one of the things that we have to do is indicate to the countries that are developing where we have made mistakes. They should not go through a Victorian-style industrial revolution. They ought to leapfrog us immediately by starting out designing their cities as much as they can. They've already often gone down the wrong path and moving towards automobile commuting.
So is India leapfrogging that when it sets up call centers and goes right to, you know, IT assistance?
Well, IT assistance may be fine. That's not a terrible thing environmentally. But when you go to Delhi now, you can get run over by the Mercedes. India has an overdeveloped rich country buried inside a vast poor country, and the same thing's happening in China.
So step back. I hate to do this, but our time is so short, and I want to understand what you're proposing as solutions here, how to get out of this box. Take us through sort of bullet style, if you would, Paul. We've just got a couple of minutes here.
Okay. First of all, the United States ought to have public forums, like we have here with your very intelligent audience, discussing issues like what are people for, what do we want our grandchildren to have, what is possible within the constraints of our society. And although the United States is widely hated, if we started talking like maybe we've made a mistake by everybody trying to commute to work by car, and that maybe we haven't thought enough about what people in leisure are for, instead of having everybody busting their, you know, their butts or two jobs for each family and so on, trying to keep their head above water, we would have a big influence on the world. We need to revise how we run our government. We need to look at the UN and how we can modify that so it's a more effective thing. We've got to start discussion of a lot of ethical issues, of a lot of governance issues and so on, and do it publicly and do it in ways that we can talk to each other rather than shout at each other. I don't have all the answers. If I had them, I'd package them and sell them to you.
Does this require centralized government? Does it work in a democracy? Does it work with individual freedom? I mean, it almost sounds...
No, I don't think you want centralized government. I don't think you want it done by the government. I think you want it done by outfits like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is transparent, open to everybody and so on, where you have continual discussion of the, you know, the serious problems we're faced.
The discussion's over and it's time to act, are you throwing all the sort of free marketeers out the window and saying we must have heavy global regulation to survive the environmental password?
No, I'm totally in favor of the markets, but I'm in favor of such things. I would never get elected to office, but in the United States, we ought to be paying $5 and $6 a gallon for gasoline to internalize all the externalities. Yeah, we should use the market, but we've got to use the market to do the things it can do well. As the economists will tell you, the problem with our markets is we don't get the prices right. We don't pay for many of the costs of gasoline when we buy it at the pump, because those costs are not included in the market price. The cost of maintaining our military in the Middle East, the cost of what happens to our lungs when we breathe the stuff the cars spew out, and so on. The markets will work if you can get the prices right, but we need the government to help to get the prices right.
But, Paul, you said it yourself. You're saying all this, and you're not running for office. If you were, you've got at least what political analysts would say is some pretty unpopular stuff here against consumption, against individualism, growth, wealth, or at least income inequality, which a lot of people seem to imagine they're going to end up on the right side of. How do you get this into the realm of policy and reality?
Well, one of the things that, that actually happens in some areas here in California is that the public is well enough informed that they actually elect people who understand these things to a degree at least and work in the right direction. And we have to do more of that. It's got to come from everybody. You cannot expect the politicians to lead in this area. You've got to make sure that they know the direction the public wants to go, and only discussion and education is going to work on that. Who said, you know, there, it's not anywhere preordained that we're going to get out of this mess. All we can do is try.
Are you hopeful?
Yeah, because I've seen society change dramatically in my now getting to be long life. I mean, when I was a kid, people were being lynched down south. You're never going to solve the world's problems if we're going to have lynching and wars between Muslims and Christians and so on. We have got to solve our problems of how we treat each other if we're going to solve our problems of how we treat the environment so that it doesn't kill us. And so I've seen that's disappeared. In about 15 years, the racist situation in the United States was very much changed, although not far enough. The Soviet Union disappeared by surprise about 15 years ago. Nobody expected that. So when the time is ripe, we can change society dramatically and rapidly, and I'm hoping that on the environmental front, that'll work. And what I think we've all got to work to do is to try and ripen the time.
Paul Ehrlich writes, "We see no choice but to attempt the possible rather than accept the unacceptable." Paul Ehrlich, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My great pleasure.
Paul Ehrlich joined me from Stanford, California. He's a professor at Stanford University in population studies and biology. His new book is One with Nineveh: Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the U.S. levies sanctions on Syria. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. After months of debate within his administration, President Bush yesterday imposed a raft of economic sanctions against Syria. The sanctions come along with charges that Syria has failed to take action against terrorist groups fighting Israel and has done little to halt the flow of foreign fighters into Iraq. Some members of Congress had pushed hard for the sanctions, including Representative Elliot Engel, Democrat from New York, who said yesterday, quote, "The United States government is sending a loud and clear message to the leaders of Syria that we will no longer turn a blind eye to their transgressions. The ball is now in Damascus's court." Today, Syrian Prime Minister Najib al-Attari, along with other members of the Arab League, denounced the U.S. sanctions. Glenn Kessler is a staff writer for The Washington Post and is covering the story. I asked him why the U.S. is imposing sanctions on Syria now.
This is an initiative that started with the Congress. In fact, the administration was not happy with the idea of imposing sanctions on Syria, at least when this bill was first proposed about 2 years ago. But they removed their objections sometime over the fall and let Congress pass the bill. And now the president has actually taken the steps outlined in the bill. The reasons he gave was because Syria, in his words, is supporting terrorism and also interfering with U.S. efforts to stabilize Iraq.
So who in Congress is pushing the sanctions and why?
The key lawmakers on the House side, which is where this started, were Representative Ross Elena Layton from Florida, as well as Elliot Engel in New York. It was a bill that was heavily promoted by pro-Israeli lobbying forces here in Washington, in part just to put pressure on Syria to end its support of Palestinian extremist groups.
Now, the sanctions themselves, you write, Glenn, are largely symbolic. Why is that?
First of all, it would ban U.S. exports to Syria except for food and medicine. But then the president also waived a number of products, such as telecommunications, which means cell phones, on the notion of promoting freedom of information. However, it should be noted that there are some U.S. manufacturers that have some very big cell phone contracts in Syria. They also exempt aircraft parts. Again, that's done on a safety concern, but I think that's also a good portion of sales for American companies. One of the sanctions is prohibiting Syrian aircraft from flying to and from the United States. Well, actually, no Syrian aircraft currently fly to and from the United States. The president did do a few things that were not in the actual law, such as cutting off relations with the Syrian Central Bank because of money laundering concerns. But by and large, it's not going to have a huge impact on the Syrian economy because the U.S. is not one of the biggest trading partners for Syria. And he doesn't end diplomatic contacts with Syria, which was one of his options as well. And that allows the ambassador to stay in Syria, and it allows, presumably, intelligence contacts to continue.
So, Glenn, do some interpretation for us here. What's the dance we're in the midst of here? If the impact is largely symbolic, what's the point?
Well, you know, diplomacy is often symbolic, and you do things or you nudge countries, particularly if you're the big, giant, 800-pound elephant known as the United States in the world, you do things to prod countries in your direction. And the administration first used even the threat of this law to try to prod Syria into taking steps that the administration wanted. Secretary of State Colin Powell went to Damascus a year ago. I was actually with him on that trip.
These are steps to what? To cut off Syrian support for Hamas and Hezbollah?
Yeah, that's one of them. Also to stop its development of weapons of mass destruction.
Is there evidence that Syria is, in fact, developing such weapons?
There's certainly chemical and biological weapons, and there's been a bit of an unstated bargain in the region, though no one will ever admit this publicly, that the Israelis have their nuclear weapons, and so the Syrians were kind of allowed, as a counterbalance to that, to have some chemical biological weapons. The Bush administration has kind of come in and tried to overturn that carefully constructed bargain in the region, basically said no weapons of mass destruction for any of those countries in the region, though they won't say much about Israel's nuclear stockpile.
Now, I thought that Syria had, in fact, been helpful to the United States in the efforts to fight terrorism.
Yes, they have been. According to administration officials, there was at least one instance where they actually thwarted a potential terrorist attack. They provided other intelligence. They also, at one point, roughed up for 10 months a guy who the United States suspected of an al-Qaeda connection when the United States shipped him on a plane where he was headed to Canada, and they stopped him in New York and headed him off to Syria. And it turned out he apparently does not have al-Qaeda connections.
There was a ripple of conversation about a year ago that U.S. forces might actually keep going after Iraq right on into Syria. Is this part of some greater plan to put pressure on Syria? To what end?
Yes, there was a lot of talk about that. I don't know how real it was, but there is a contingent within the administration that feels that you just want to get rid of all the problem countries there, and Iraq has a border with Syria and with Iran, and they view both of those countries as problem countries, in part because they supply or assist terrorist groups that are undertaking attacks against Israel. And if you eliminate the sources of terrorist groups in Syria and Iran, you make life much easier for the Israelis.
A lot of bitter response from across the Mideast today to these sanctions, symbolic though they may be.
Yes, that's also part of the way diplomacy works. Everyone is going to complain about these. And, you know, there is a threat of additional sanctions. As I started to say before, Secretary Powell went to Syria and said that if Syria does not take these steps that the administration had wanted on terrorism, on weapons of mass destruction, this law would get passed and ultimately would be implemented. The CIA was not happy about this at all. They would like to have as much intelligence cooperation from the Syrians as possible. And that was one reason why the president more or less sat on this bill for 5 months before he acted yesterday.
But now, with pressure from Congress that you described, it's happened. Israel must be pleased?
Yes, the Israelis are quite pleased. Syria is part of a potential solution in the Middle East conflict. They nearly came to an agreement with the Israelis a few years ago. Additional pressure on Syria might, in some people's minds, make it more likely for Syria to end the support of those terrorist groups and reach an agreement with Israel on the Golan Heights.
Glenn Kessler, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Glenn Kessler is a staff writer for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.